mine own cousin dear, gramercy of your cost and of your cheer. This noble merchant, gently anon, answered and said, O cousin mine, Dawn John, now sickerly, this is a small request. My gold is yours, when that it you lest, and not only my gold, but my chaffair. Take what you list, God's shield that you spare. But one thing is, you know it well enow, of chapmen, that their money is their plough. We may creance, while we have a name, but goldless for to be, it is no game. Pay it again when it lies in your ease, after my might full fain would I you please. These 100 francs he fetched forth anon, and privily he took them to Dawn John. No wight in all this world wist of this loan, saving this merchant and Dawn John alone. They drink and speak and roam a while and play, till that Dawn John rideth to his abbey. The morrow came, and forth this merchant rides to Flanders ward. His prentice well him guides, till he came into Bruges merrily. Now goes this merchant fast and busily about his need, and buyeth and creanceth. He neither playeth at the dice nor danceth, but as a merchant, shortly for to tell, he led his life, and there I let him dwell. The Sunday next the merchant was agone. To Saint Denis he common is Dawn John, with crown and beard all fresh and new he shave. In all the house there nas so little a knave, nor no wight else that he nas full fain, that my lord Dawn John was come again. And shortly to the point, right for to gone, this fair wife accorded with Dawn John, that for these 100 francs he should all night have her in his arms bolt upright. And this accord performed was indeed. In mirth all night a busy life they lead, till it was day that Dawn John went his way, and bade the meinie, farewell, have good day, for none of them, nor no wight in the town, has of Dawn John right no suspicion. And forth he rideth home to his abbey, or where him list. No more of him, I say. This merchant, when that ended was the fair, to Saint Denis he gan for to repair, and with his wife he maketh feast and cheer, and telleth her that chaffer is so dear, that needs must he make a chevisance, for he was bound and a recognizance to pay 20,000 shields anon, for which this merchant is to Paris gone, to borrow of certain friends that he had a certain francs, and some with him he led. And when that he was come into the town, for great charity and great affection, unto Dawn John he first goes, him to play, not for to ask or borrow of him money, but for to wit and see of his welfare, and for to tellen him of his chaffare, as friends do when they be met I fear. Dawn John him maketh feast and merry cheer, and he him told again full specially how he had well he bought and graciously. Thanked be God, all whole his merchandise, save that he must in all manner wise maken a chevisance as for the best, and then should he in joy be and in rest. Dawn John answered, certes I am fain that you in health are comen home again, and if that I were rich, as have I bliss, of 20,000 shields should you not miss, for you so kindly this other day lent me gold, and as I can and may, I thank you by God and by St. James. But natheless, I took unto our dame, your wife at home, the same gold again, upon your bench. She wot it well, certain, by certain tokens that I can you tell. Now, by your leave, I may no longer dwell. Our abbot will out of this town anon, and in his company must I gone. Greet well our dame, mine own niece sweet, and farewell, dear cousin, till we meet. This merchant, which that was full ware and wise, creancered has, and paid eke in Paris, to certain Lombards ready in their hand, the sum of gold, and got of them his bond. And home he goes, merry as a popinjay, for well he knew he stood in such array, that needs must he win in that viage, 1,000 francs above all his costage. His wife full ready met him at the gate, as she was wont of old usage all gate, and all that night in mirth they beset, for he was rich and clearly out of debt. When it was day, this merchant gan embrace his wife all new, and kissed her on her face. And up he goes, and maketh it full tough. "No more," quod she, "by God, you have enough." And wantonly again with him she played, till at the last thus this merchant said, "By God," quod he, "I am a little wroth with you, my wife, although it be me loath. And wot you why? By God, as that I guess, that you have made a manner strangeness betwixt me and my cousin Dorn John. You should have warned me ere I had gone, that he to you 100 francs had paid, by ready token. He held him ill apaid, for that I to him spoke of chevisance, me seemed so as by his countenance. But natheless, by God our heaven king, I thought not to ask of him no thing. I pray thee, wife, na do thou no more so. Tell me always, ere that I from thee go, if any debtor has in mine absence y paid thee, lest through thy negligence I might him ask a thing that he has paid." This wife was not afeard nor afraid, but boldly she said, and that anon, "Marry, I defy the false monk Dorn John. I keep not of his token, never a deal. He took me certain gold, this wot I well. What, evil thedom on his monk's snout! For God it wot, I wend withouten doubt, that he had given it me because of you, to do therewith my honour and my prow, for cousinage, and eke for bella cheer, that he has had full often times here. But since I see I stand in this disjoint, I will answer you shortly to the point. You have more slacker debtors than am I, for I will pay you well and readily from day to day, and if so be I fail, I am your wife, score it upon my tail. And I shall pay as soon as ever I may, for by my truth I have on my array, and not in waste, bestowed every deal. And for I have bestowed it so well, for your honour, for God's sake I say, as be not wroth, but let us laugh and play. You shall my jolly body have to wed. By God, I will not pay you but a bed. Forgive it me, mine own spouse so dear, turn hitherward, and maketh better cheer." This merchant saw there was no remedy, and for to chide it ne'er but great folly, since that the thing may not amended be. "Now, wife," he said, "and I forgive it thee, but by thy life, ne be no more so large. Keep bet my good, this give I thee in charge." Thus endeth now my tale, and God ascend, tailing enough unto our life's end.
"Well said, by Corpus Dominus," quod our host. "Now long may thou sail by the coast, Sir Gentle Master, Gentle Mariner. God give the monk 1,000 last quod year. Ah, oh, fellows, beware of such a jape. The monk put in the man's hood an ape, and in his wife's eke, by Saint Austin, draweth no monks more into your inn. But now, pass over, and let us seek about. Who shall now tell first of all this rout another tale? And with that word he said, as courteously as it had been a maid, My lady prioress, by your leave, so that I wist I should you not grieve, I would demon that you tell and should a tale next, if so were that you would. Now will you vouchsafe, my lady dear? Gladly, quod she, and said as you shall hear.
This ends Disc 11. The Canterbury Tales, Disc 12.
The prioress, who has just been addressed with such uncharacteristic respect by the host, Harry Bailey, tells, appropriately enough, a pious story, suitable to both her profession and to aspects of her personality that we have seen in the general prologue. It is a tale designed to appeal more to the feelings than to the mind, not to convince or persuade, but to move with emotional feeling. It has some interesting contrasts, pious sentimentality side by side with ethnic bias and ready acceptance of the terrible punishment of the guilty. A stress on simplicity side by side with some elaboration in the verse. Praise of virginity together with intense feeling for motherhood. There are some other well-tried elements of affecting narrative or drama. The innocent little son of the widowed mother murdered on the way home from school and his body thrown in a cesspool. The poor mother, frantic when he does not come home, eventually finding him dead. His miraculous revival to sing and speak in honour of Our Lady the Virgin Mary, and then pass away finally to his eternal reward. One critic, Alfred David, regards the story as a kind of fairy tale turned into hagiography, the life story of a saint, complete with uncomplex innocents and villains who have no personalities, no psychologies, but are simply good or bad. The boy is little, young, tender, etc. The villains are cursed, a wasp's nest of Satan, who conspire to murder the little boy. Fairy tales and saints' lives have villains who are impossibly bad and victims who are impossibly good. But the prioress's tale is affectingly sentimental in ways that the folk tale or the saint's legend rarely are. It is also uninterested in the sometimes gruesome details that characterize the descriptions of the penances of the saintly or the tortures of the martyred in collections of saints' lives like The Golden Legend. Critics who remark on the prioress's pitiless attitude towards the murderers or her overt streak of cruelty masked as pious hatred are neglecting medieval hagiography, where they would read, as Chaucer and his prioress had read, and as Horatio in Hamlet perhaps had read, of carnal, bloody, and unnatural acts, of accidental judgments, casual slaughters, of deaths put on by cunning and forced cause, and in the upshot purposes mistook, fallen on the inventors' heads.
The Canterbury Tales, Disc 2.
The knight proceeds to tell what is, at least on the surface, a romance, that is, in medieval terms, a tale of love and war, or, as we might put it, sex and violence. But the sex is in no way erotic or earthy, as it is in other tales. There is not much romance in our sense of the word. In fact, it is a largely allegorical tale, where the characterization, plot, and dialogue are deliberately thin, probably because they function mostly to carry ideas or questions about destiny, fortune, free will, war, prayer, the existence and benevolence of God, the power of lust, the frailty of vows, and so on. matters which a poet feels happier treating in a fictional form than in a philosophical treatise. At the beginning, Theseus, Duke of Athens, has got himself a bride by conquering the Amazons, a race of warrior women, taking their leader as his wife, not a very romantic way to begin a romance. On the way home with his bride from his victorious war, Theseus is shocked to hear that Creon of Thebes will not allow some widows to bury their dead warrior husbands. So the conquering hero starts and finishes another war, sparing only the lives of two young Theban nobles whom he throws into prison for life. Where, oddly enough, romance begins, as both young men fall instantly in love with Emily, the beautiful sister of the Duchess, whom they can only see through their prison window. They promptly start quarrelling over her, though she doesn't even know they exist. One of them, called Archite, manages to get released on condition that he stay out of Athens. The other, called Palamon, remains in jail. "Who is better off?" the narrator asks. "Archite, who is free but expelled from sight of Emily, or Palamon, who can see her every day from prison?" Here is part one of The Knight's Tale, which is read in its entirety by George Guidel. Fully developed versions of such things can be found in the life of almost any martyr. The casual way in which bloody and unnatural acts are recounted in the prioress's tale is really part of the genre, and says little about her personally. It is matched again and again in the hagiographical collections, but with the difference that Madame Eglantine's fastidiousness, or Chaucer's, spares us most of the ugly details. The Jewish villains are no more sharply conceived than the city or the other citizens, all of them nameless. As David Benson remarks, they are the villains as the Muslims are in the Man of Law's tale, or the Romans in the Second Nun's tale. They are all infidels of one sort or another. Since the Second World War, we have all become more conscious of nominating villains in that sort of stereotyped way, especially Jews. Only recently, with the case of Salman Rushdie and the Satanic Verses, have we been sensitized, perhaps, to the feelings of another and even larger group of people, the Muslims, an easy contempt for whom can sometimes be found in medieval writers totally ignorant of their beliefs. In Chaucer's English, for example, the word for an idol was Maumet, spelled Maumet, clearly a version of the name Mohammed, and Maumetry meant idolatry, although idolatry most certainly has never had any place in Muslim life or worship. Jews or Muslims or Romans are the villains in some of these medieval tales told by a Catholic Christian, as Catholics became in much English literature written by Protestant Christians from the Reformation onwards. This is most markedly true of Gothic novels of the Monk Lewis variety, where the immorality of the monk or nun is not just casually mentioned, but is painted in full vivid colours, savouring every cruel or lascivious moment, a kind of pious pornography made safe for the prurient reader by the supposed wickedness of the perpetrators. The prioress's tale is chaste and restrained by comparison. Jews or Muslims were to the medieval audience who had met neither as vaguely sinister or as wicked as monks and nuns were to many 19th-century Anglo-Saxons who had never met either. An ironic turn of fortune's wheel. The tale's mixture of sentiment, prejudice, pathos, and horror succeeds in its own way with the pilgrims, as did the Fablio of the Miller or the Romance of the Knight. Here follows the prioress's prologue and tale, narrated by Davina Porter.
"Domine, Dominus Noster. O Lord, our Lord, thy name how marvellous is in this large world y spread, quod she. For not only thy Lord Precious performed is by men of dignity, but by the mouth of children thy bounty performed is. For on the breast sucking, sometimes showen they thy herrying. Wherefore, in Lord, as best I can or may of thee and of the white lily flower, which that thee bore, and is a maid alway, to tell a story I will do my labour. Not that I may increase in her honour, for she herself is honour, and the root of bounty, next her son and soul's boot. O mother maid, O maiden mother free, O bush unburnt, burning in Moses' sight, that ravishedest down from the deity, through thy humbless, the ghost that in thee alight, of whose virtue, when he thine heart light conceived, was the father's sapience. Help me to tell it in thy reverence. Lady, thy bounty, thy magnificence, thy virtue, and thy great humility, there may no tongue express in no science. For sometimes, lady, ere men pray to thee, thou goest before of thy benignity, and gettest us the light of thy prayer, to guide us unto thy son so dear. My cunning is so weak, O blissful queen, for to declare thy great worthiness, that I no may the weight not sustain. But as a child of 12 months old or less, that can a nephew any word express right, so fare I. And therefore, I you pray, guideth my song that I shall of you say. There was in Asia, in a great city, amongst Christian folk, a jury sustained by a lord of that country for foul usury and lucre of villainy hateful to Christ and to his company. And through the street men might ride and wend, for it was free and open at either end. A little school of Christian folk there stood, down at the farther end, in which there were children a heap, y-come of Christian blood, that learned in that school, year by year, such manner doctrine as men used there. That is to say, to singen and to read, as small children do in their childhood. Among these children was a widow's son, a little clergyman, 7 years of age, that day by day to school was his one, and eke also, where, as he saw the image of Christ's mother, had he in usage, as him was taught, to kneel adown and say his Ave Mary, as he goes by the way. Thus hath this widow her little son y taught, our blissful lady, Christ's mother dear, to worship I, and he forgot it not. For silly child will all day soon leer, but I, when I remember on this matter, St. Nicholas stands ever in my presence, for he so young to Christ did reverence. This little child, his little book learning, as he sat in the school at his primer, he Alma Redemptoris heard sing, as children learn their antiphona. And as he durst, he drew him near and near, and hearkened I the words and the note, till he the first verse could all by rote. Nought wist he what this Latin was to say, for he so young and tender was of age. But on a day his fellow gan he pray to expound in him this song in his language, or tell him why this song was in usage. This prayed he him to construe and declare, full often time upon his knees bare. His fellow, which that elder was than he, answered him thus. This song, I have heard say, was maked of our blissful lady free, her to salute, and eke her for to pray to be our help and succour when we die. I can no more expound in this matter. I learn song. I can but small grammar. And is this song maked in reverence of Christ's mother? Said this innocent. Now, certes, I will do my diligence to con it all ere Christmas is went, though that I for my primer shall be shent, and shall be beaten thrice in an hour. I will it con Our Lady for to honour. His fellow taught him homeward privily, from day to day, till he could it by rote. And then he sang it well and boldly, from word to word, according with the note. Twice a day it passed through his throat, to schoolward and homeward when he went. On Christ's mother set was his intent. As I have said, throughout the jury, this little child, as he came to and fro, full merrily would he sing and cry, O Alma Redemptoris, evermore. The sweetness hath his heart pierced so of Christ's mother, that to her to pray he cannot stint of singing by the way. Our first foe, the serpent Satanas, that hath in Jew's heart his wasp's nest, upswelled and said, O Hebraic people, alas, is this to you a thing that is honest, that such a boy shall walken as him lest in your despite, and sing of such sentence, which is against your law's reverence? From thenceforth the Jews have conspired this innocent out of the world to chase. A homicide thereto have they hired, that in an alley had a privy place. And as the child gan forby for to pace, this cursed Jew him hent, and held him fast, and cut his throat, and in a pit him cast. I say that in a wardrobe they him threw, whereas these Jews purge in their entrail. O cursed folk of Herodes, all new, what may your evil intent you avail? Murder will out, certain it will not fail. And namely there the honour of God shall spread, the blood outcrieth on your cursed deed. O martyr sounded to virginity, now mayest thou singen, following ever in one the white lamb celestial, quod she, of which the great evangelist St. John in Patmos wrote, which says that they that gone before this lamb and sing a song all new, that never fleshly women they ne knew. This poor widow waiteth all that night after her little child, but he came not, for which, as soon as it was day's light, with face pale of dread and busy thought, she has at school and elsewhere him sought. Till, finally, she gan so far espy that he last seen was in the jury. With mother's pity in her breast enclosed, she goes, as she were half out of her mind, to every place where she hath supposed by likelihood her little child to find. And ever on Christ's mother, meek and kind, she cried. And at the last thus she wrought among the cursed Jews she him sought. She freineth, and she prayeth piteously to every Jew that dwelt in Vilka place, to tell her if her child went aught forby. They said, nay. But Jesus, of his grace, gave in her thought, within a little space, that in that place after her son she cried where he was casten in a pit beside. O great God, that performest thy Lord by mouth of innocence, lo, hear thy might, this gem of chastity, this emerald and eke of martyrdom, the ruby bright. There, he, with throaty carven, lay upright. He, Alma Redemptoris, gan to sing so loud that all the place began to ring. The Christian folk that through the street went in common for to wonder on this thing, and hastily they for the provost sent. He came anon, withouten tarrying, and hearieth Christ, that is of heaven king, and eke his mother, honour of mankind. and after that the Jews let he bind. This child, with piteous lamentation, uptaken was, singing his song alway, and with honour of great procession they carry him unto the next abbey. His mother, swooning by this bier, lay, unnetha might the people that was there, this new Rachel bringen from his bier. With torment, and with shameful death, each one the provost doth these Jews for to starve, that of this murder wist, and that anon, he would no such cursedness observe. Evil shall have what evil will deserve. Therefore, with wild horse he did them draw, and after that he hung them by the law. Upon his bier I lies this innocent before the chief altar, while mass lasts. And after that, the abbot with his convent have sped them for to bury him full fast. And when they holy water on him cast, yet spoke this child when sprend was holy water, and sang, O Alma Redemptoris, Mater. This abbot, which that was a holy man, as monks been, or else ought to be, this young child to conjure he began, and said, O dear child, I holso thee in virtue of the Holy Trinity. Tell me, what is thy cause for to sing, since that thy throat is cut, to my seeming? My throat is cut unto my neck-bone, said this child, and as by way of kind I should have died, yea, long time ago. But Jesus Christ, as you in books find, wills that his glory last and be in mind. And for the worship of his mother dear, yet may I sing, O Alma, loud and clear. This well of mercy, Christ's mother sweet, I loved always as after my cunning. And when that I my life should forleet, to me she came, and bade me for to sing this anthem verily in my dying, as you have heard. And when that I had sung, methought she laid a grain upon my tongue. Wherefore I sing, and sing must, certain, in honour of that blissful maiden free, till from my tongue oft taken is the grain. And after that thus said she unto me, My little child, now will I fetch thee, when that the grain is from thy tongue ye take. Be not aghast, I will thee not forsake. This holy monk, this abbot, him mean I, his tongue outcaught, and took away the grain, and he gave up the ghost full softly. And when this abbot had this wonder seen, his salt tears trickled down as rain, and gruff he fell all plat upon the ground, and still he lay as he had been y bound. The convent eke lay on the pavement weeping and harrying Christ's mother dear, and after that they rise and forth been went, and took away this martyr from his bier. And in a tomb of marble stones clear enclosen they his little body sweet, where he is now, God leave us, for to meet. O young Hugh of Lincoln, slain also with cursed Jews, as it is notable, for it is but a little while ago, pray eat for us, we sinful folk unstable, that of his mercy God so merciable, on us his great mercy multiply, for reverence of his mother Mary. Amen.
This ends the Prioress's tale. The nun's priest is not described in the general prologue, just mentioned. After the description of the prioress, the head of a convent of nuns, we are told that another nun with her had she, that was her chaplain, and priests three. which means that she was accompanied by a nun companion, who is called her chaplain, a normal arrangement. But bringing along three priests as chaplains in our sense of the word seems both odd and excessive. Some scholars say that the phrase "and priests three" was not Chaucer's, but was inserted by a scribe. We get a little more information about him from the host, who addresses him with what might seem undue familiarity. The priest rides a nag that is both foul and lean, a sure sign that he is not well off, hence the innkeeper's lack of respect. And at the end of the tale, we also learn that the nun's priest is, unlike his nag, solidly built, a virile-looking man, wasted in a celibate profession, according to Harry. The nun's priest is a priest, a rather obvious statement that has a considerable bearing on his tale, for priests were, and are, by profession, preachers. And the tale that our priest tells has a great deal in common with the medieval sermon, except that it is not boring, as sermons have a reputation of being. The argument is carried on to a sizable degree by a common medieval method, the exemplum. The exemplum is an anecdote, brief or extended, told to illustrate the point being made in an argument or a sermon. There is a string of these in this tale, ranging from biblical references of one or two lines each to a passage of around 80 lines about the two travelling salesmen. From English history to Old Testament history to stories from Latin literature. These were, at the same time, colourful anecdotes to hold the attention of an audience, and authorities, that is, authoritative sources adduced to bolster the assertions of the speaker or writer. The people of the Middle Ages believed greatly in authorities. The tale itself is a beast fable, an exemplum with moral attached, a form that goes back to the Greek of Aesop and that is still familiar in cartoons. The animals talk, discuss medicine, argue about dream theory, and so on. This is absurd and acceptable in turn. For example, that they should talk seems acceptable enough, and has been since Aesop. But that the hen should comment on the absence of a local drugstore, where one could get laxatives, and that her husband should quote Cato, is deliciously daft. One of the subjects that the animals talk about is the significance of dreams, one of Chaucer's favourite subjects. For Chaucer was interested in the theory of dreams long before Freud, and the discussion between the cock and the hen in the tale represents well enough the differing points of view in the Middle Ages about the origin and significance of dreams. Another topic favoured by Chaucer, and much argued in the Middle Ages, but somehow a great deal less plausible in this context, and hence perhaps more comic, is the problem of free will. If you do something, do you do it because you were really free to do it, or did you have to do it? Since God foresaw from all eternity that you would or would not do it, does that imply that you were not free to choose in the first place? Is free will a delusion? Since this argument generally occurred in the context of discussion about sin and eternal salvation, it was a deeply serious matter for many people. Introducing such a problem into a barnyard squabble between a cock and a hen is comic, but it doesn't dismiss the topic as ridiculous in itself, just as it doesn't reduce the significance of the fall of Troy or the burning of Carthage because they are comically compared to the goings-on in the widow's yard. Like most beast fables, the nun's priest's tale ends, as we said, with a moral, rather tongue-in-cheek in this case, addressed to him who trusts in flattery and to him who jangles when he should hold his peace. Take the morality, good men. Or, to put it another way, take the fruit and let the chaff be still. You can decide which is which, or just enjoy the story. Here, after the knight interrupts the monk's tale, which has become rather tedious. There follow the nun's priest's prologue and tale, narrated by John Rayner.
"Whoa!" quod the knight. "Good sir, no more of this. What you have said is right enough, I wis, and muchel more. For little heaviness is right enough to muchel folk, I guess. I say for me, it is a great dis-ease. Whereas men have been in great wealth and ease, to hearen of their sudden fall, alas! And the contrary is joy and great solace, as when a man has been in poor estate, and climbeth up and waxeth fortunate, and there abideth in prosperity. Such thing is gladsome, as it thinketh me, and of such thing were goodly for to tell."
"Yea," quod our host, "by St. Paul's bell, you say right, sooth. This monk, he clappeth loud. He spoke of fortune covered with a cloud, I note never what, and also of tragedy right now you heard. And, pardee, no remedy it is for to bewail, nor to complain that that is done. And also 'tis a pain, as you have said, to hear of heaviness. Sir monk, no more of this. So God you bless. Your tale annoyeth all this company. Such talking is not worth a butterfly, for therein is there no disport nor game. Wherefore, sir monk, Dom Piers by your name, I pray you heartily, tell us somewhat else. For sickly, now clinking of your bells that on your bridle hang on every side, by heaven's king that for us all died, I should ere this have fallen down for sleep, although the slough had never been so deep, than had your tale all been told in vain. For certainly, as that these clerks sayn, whereas a man may have no audience, nought helpeth it to tell in his sentence. And well I wot the substance is in me, if anything shall well reported be. Sir, say somewhat of hunting, I you pray."
"Nay," quod this monk, "I have no lust to play. Now let another tell as I have told." Then spoke our host with rude speech and bold, and said unto the nun's priest anon,
"Come near, thou priest, come hither, thou Sir John. Tell us such thing as may our hearts glad. Be blithe, although thou ride upon a jade. What, though thine horse be both foul and lean, if he will serve thee, reck thee not a bean. Look that thine heart be merry evermo'."
"Yes, sir," quod he. "Yes, host, so may I go, but I be merry, I wis I will be blamed." And right anon his tale he has attamed, and thus he said unto us every one, this sweet priest, this goodly man, Sir John. A poor widow, some deal stape in age, was whilom dwelling in a narrow cottage, beside a grove, standing in a dale. This widow, of which I tell to you my tale, since thilke day that she was last a wife, in patience led a full, simple life. For little was her chattel and her rent, by husbandry of such as God her sent, she found herself, and eke her daughters, too. 3 large sows had she, and no more, 3 kine, and eke a sheep that hight a maul. Full sooty was her bower, and eke her hall, in which she ate full many a slender meal, of poignant sauce her needed never a deal. No dainty morsel passed through her throat, her diet was accordant to her coat. Repletion made her never sick, a temperate diet was all her physic, and exercise, and heart's sufficance. The gout let her nothing for to dance, no apoplexy shent not her head, no wine drank she, neither white nor red. Her board was served most with white and black, milk and brown bread, in which she found no lack. Signed bacon, and sometime an egg or tway, for she was, as it were, a manor day. A yard she had, enclosed all about with sticks and a dry ditch without, in which she had a cock, hight Chanticleer. In all the land of crowing, Nass his peer. His voice was merrier than the merry organ on mass days that in the church gone. Well sickerer was his crowing in his lodge than is a clerk or any abbey or lodge. By nature he knew each ascension of the equinoctial in Thilkertown, for when degrees 15 were ascended, then crew he that it might not be amended. His comb was redder than the fine coral, and battled, as it were, a castle wall. His bill was black, and as the jet it shone. Like azure were his legs and his tone, his nails whiter than the lily flower, and like the burned gold was his colour. This gentle cock had in his governance 7 hens, for to do all his pleasance, which were his sisters and his paramours, and wonder like to him as of colours, of which the fairest hued on her throat was Cleped fair damoiselle Pertelote. Courteous she was, discreet and debonair, and companionable, and bore herself so fair since Thilke day that she was 7 night old, that truly she has the heart in hold of Chanticleer, locked in every lith. He loved her so, that well was him therewith. But such a joy it was to hear them sing, when that the bright sun began to spring, in sweet accord, My leaf is fair in land. For Thilke time, as I have understand, beasts and birds could speak and sing. And so befell, that in a dawning, as Chanticleer among his wives all sat on his perch that was in the hall, and next him sat this fair Pertelote, this Chanticleer gan groanen in his throat, as man that in his dream is dretched sore. And when that Pertelote thus heard him roar, she was aghast, and said,
"Oh, heart dear, what aileth you to groan in this manner? You be a very sleeper, fie for shame."
And he answered, and said thus, "Madame, I pray that you take it not a grief. By God, I dreamt I was in such mischief right now, that yet mine heart is sore affright.
Now God," quod he,
"must sweven read aright, and keep my body out of foul prison. I dreamt how that I roamed up and down within our yard, whereas I saw a beast was like a hound, and would have made a rest upon my body, and have had me dead. His colour was betwixt yellow and red, and tippered was his tail and both his ears with black, unlike the remnant of his hairs. His snout small, with glowing iron tway, yet of his look for fear almost I die. This caused me my groaning, doubtless."
"Avoy," quod she, "fie on you, heartless." "Alas," quod she, "for by the God above, now have you lost my heart and all my love. I cannot love a coward by my faith. For certes, whatso any woman saith, we all desirin, if it might be, to have husbands hardy, wise, and free, and secret, and no niggard, nor no fool, nor him that is aghast of every tool, nor no avaunter, by that God above. How durst you say for shame unto your love that anything might maken you afeard? Have you no man's heart, and have a beard? Alas, and can you be aghast of swetherness? Nothing, God wot, but vanity in sweven is. Swevens engender of repletions, and oft of fumes and of complexions, when humours be too abundant in a wight. Certes, this dream which you have met to-night comes of the great superfluity of your red collar, pardee, which causeth folk to dreaden in their dreams of arrows and of fire with red leams, of red beasts that they will them bite, of contig and of whelps great and light. Right as the humour of melancholy causeth full many a man in sleep to cry, for fear of black bears or bulls black, or else that black devils will them take. Of other humours could I tell also, that work in many a man in sleep full woe, but I will pass as lightly as I can. Lo, Cato, which that was so wise a man, said he not thus, nor do no force of dreams. Now, sir, quod she, when we fly from the beams, for God's love, as take some laxative. On peril of my soul and of my life, I counsel you the best, I will not lie, that both of choler and of melancholy you purge you, and for you shall not tarry, though in this town is no apothecary. I shall myself to herbs teachen you, that shall be for your health and for your prow. And in our yard those herbs shall I find, the which have of their property by kind to purgeon you beneath and eke above. Forget not this for God's own love. You be full choleric of complexion. Beware the sun in his ascension, ne find you not replete of humours hot. And if it do, I dare well lay a groat that you shall have a fever tertiane, or an ague that may be your bane. A day or two you shall have digestives of worms, ere you take your laxatives of laureole, centaury, and fumitaire, or else of hellebore that groweth there, of catapuse or of gator berries, or herb ivy growing in our yard. There merit is, pick them right up as they grow and eat them in. Be merry, husband, for your father's kin. Dreadeth no dream, I can say you no more.
Madame, quod he, gramercy of your law, but natheless, as touching Don Caton, that has of wisdom such a great renown, though that he bad no dreams for to dread, by God, men may in olden books read of many a man, more of authority than ever Cato was, so may I thee, that all the reverse say of this sentence, and have well founded by experience, that dreams be significations, as well of joy as tribulations, that folk enduring in this life present, there needeth make of this no argument, the very proof showeth it indeed. One of the greatest authors that men read says thus, that whilom two fellows went on pilgrimage in a full good intent. And happened so, they came into a town, where as there was such congregation of people, and eke so straight of herby gauge, that they ne found as much as one cottage, in which they might both elodged be. Wherefore they must, of necessity, as for that night, departing company. And each of them goes to his hostelry, and took his lodging as it would fall. That one of them was lodged in a stall, far in a yard, with oxen of the plough. The other man was lodged well enow, as was his aventure or his fortune, that us governeth all as in commune. And so befell, that long ere it were day, this man dreamt in his bed, there as he lay, how that his fellow gan upon him call, and said, "Alas, for in an ox's stall this night shall I be murdered where I lie. Now help me, dear brother, or I die. In all haste come to me," he said. This man, out of his sleep for fear abrayed, but when that he was wakened of his sleep, he turned him and took of this no keep. Him thought his dream was but a vanity. Thus twice in his sleeping dreamed he,
and at the third time yet his fellow came, as him thought, and said, I am now slaw. Behold my bloody wounds deep and wide. Arise up early in the morrow tide, and at the west gate of the town, quod he, a cart full of dung there shalt thou see, in which my body is hid full privily. Do, Filker cart, arrest and boldly. My gold caused my murder, sooth to sayn. And told him every point how he was slain, with a full piteous face pale of hue, and trusteth well, his dream he found full true. For on the morrow, as soon as it was day, to his fellow's inn he took the way, and when that he came to this ox's stall, after his fellow he began to call. The hostler answered him anon, and said,
Sir, your fellow is agone. As soon as day he went out of the town.
This man gan fallen in suspicion, remembering on his dreams that he met, and forth he goes, no longer would he let, unto the west gate of the town, and found a dung cart, as it were to dung the land, that was arrayed in that same wise as you have heard the dead man devise. And with a hardy heart he gan to cry vengeance and justice of this felon I. My fellow murdered is this same night, and in this cart here he lies gaping upright. I cry out on the ministers, quod he, that should keep and rule in this city. Harrow, alas, here lies my fellow slain. What should I more unto this tale sayn? The people outstart, and cast the cart to ground, and in the middle of the dung they found the dead man, that murdered was all new.
Whilom, as olden stories tellen us, there was a duke that hight Theseus. Of Athens he was lord and governor, and in his time such a conqueror, that greater was there none under the sun. Full many a rich country had he won, what with his wisdom and his chivalry, he conquered all the realm of Femini, that whilom was yclepid Scythia, and wedded the queen, Hippolyta, and brought her home with him in his country, with much glory and great solemnity, and eke her young sister, Emily. And thus, with victory and with melody, let I this noble duke to Athens ride, and all his host in arms him beside. And certes, if it ne'er too long to hear, I would have told you fully the manner how wonnen was the realm of Femini by Theseus and by his chivalry, and of the great battle for the nonce betwixt in Athens and the Amazons, and how besieged was Hippolyta, the fair hardy queen of Scythia, and of the feast that was at their wedding, and of the tempest at their homecoming. But all that thing I must as now forbear. I have, God wot, a large field to air, and weak be the oxen in my plough. The remnant of the tale is long enough. I will not letten eke none of this rout. Let every fellow tell his tale about, and let's see now who shall the supper win. And where I left, I will again begin. This duke, of whom I make mention, when he was coming almost to the town, in all his weal and in his most pride, he was ware as he cast his eye aside, where that there kneeled in the highway a company of ladies, tway and tway, each after other, clad in clothes black. But such a cry, and such a woe they make, that in this world needs creature living that heard such another wamenting. And of this cry they would not ever stent, till they the reins of his bridle hent. What folk be ye that at mine homecoming perturbin so my feast with your crying? Quod Theseus. Have you so great envy of mine honour, that thus complain and cry? Or who has you misboden or offended, and telleth me, if it may be amended, and why that you be